ask me.
Okay. The light's dim, the spotlight's on, I'm off. All right. My name's Peter Smith. I'm at Imperial College Business School and an Institute for Global Health. And welcome to this session on managing public services by numbers. It's an interesting title. Makes you wonder what else you might manage by, but maybe we'll hear about that in the talks and the discussion. It was almost exactly 160 years ago that Florence Nightingale proposed that we started measuring the performance of London hospitals by measuring the number of people who were dead, relieved or unrelieved, emerging from those hospitals. It took us 150 years to improve on dead and alive, and we're still struggling. And, of course, Florence Nightingale was defeated by the combined efforts of the medical profession and an indifferent government. So it really has been a revolution, which I would suggest started in about 1983 when local governments had to start publishing annual reports with comparative statistics in, and the NHS started producing big, turgid volumes of financial data with which managers were supposed to improve their services. I think the interesting thing with that early experience was just how little attention was paid to data. The NHS had 412 performance indicators, including hospital mortality rates, through most of the 1980s, and yet it didn't create nearly the storm that we've seen, for example, in the last week with the Dr. Foster publication of their league tables. So something profound has changed, something profound has happened, and the programme has focused quite strongly on the numbers and the management by numbers and what has evolved over the last 20 years. So to address that, we've got three very distinguished speakers. We've got Tim Holt, who is Professor Emeritus at Southampton University, was former President of the Royal Statistical Society and Director of the Office of National Statistics. Tim Learning, who's from the London School of Economics, Department of Economic History, and Tim can probably tell us more, therefore, about Florence Nightingale than I can. We've got Deborah Wilson from Bristol, who's also the deputy director of this programme. So we're going to stick to 10 minutes for everyone, and then I shall reiterate, no, I won't reiterate, I'll just say it now, some nice, short, snappy interventions from the audience, and I hope we have a good discussion after that. So we'll go in the order in which they're listed, so we'll start with Tim. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you for the invitation. The brief, as Peter has outlined, really is to try to draw lessons from across the various research programmes that have been undertaken and to see what we can learn from those, and in particular what we can learn from those within the context of the future. And as we've heard this morning, most people's main issue with the future is, of course, the austerity of public finances and what is likely to occur as a result of greatly reduced public expenditure, particularly on things which are not seen to be absolutely frontline services. I have a second factor, which I think Peter has slightly alluded to, which is that there has been this huge growth from 1997 onwards in the use of performance indicators and the use of, if you like, what works in terms of delivery of public services, the drive for increased efficiency, but also the drive for of more effectiveness and accountability for public services. And I say 1997 because it seems to me that part of the step change that Peter alluded to was actually the change in administration, and the other big change which is likely to come next year, of course, is a change in administration. And I think it's less clear, if you like, what the implications of that might be in terms of the public environment, if you like, for providing and producing performance indicator information, less clear than the issues about public finances. So lesson number one, and I can go through these quite briefly because I think we've had a run of these all in the last session this morning. Lesson number one is that performance indicators can work to improve outcomes and or efficiency. And the example that everyone's been alluding to is the comparison of waiting list data between Scotland and England and the great reduction in waiting list statistics in England, where there was a very strong drive to achieve that. I jumped quickly on from that. I'll accept people have already referred to that. Jumped quickly on from that. And it's really the other side, I think, of the same coin, is this concern that indicators can distort priorities away from the other aspects of the service. The things which are measured are more likely to improve, or at the very least, are likely to improve more than other aspects of the service. And indeed, if you look back through the late 90s and into the first 5-6 years of this century, what we have seen actually over time is that the introduction of extra indicators being devised in order to, in some cases, to balance the impact across different aspects of a service, to try to rebalance, if you like, away from too great an emphasis on a small number of targets for specific services. And we've seen that in health, education, and in judicial system and so on. So my first implication, if you like, from that, and it was referred to this morning, is that if there is a severe pressure on public finances, one of the ways that that pressure is likely to be articulated is to argue for a great slimming down in terms of the number of indicators. But the implication of that is that if we have fewer indicators, then this potential for distortion, at least the potential for distortion, may greatly increase. The second lesson, or the next lesson that I draw from this too, is that the comment I've just made about any distortion in priorities and the service which is provided can be greatly exacerbated by the choice of inappropriate or extreme targets. And just I draw a distinction between a target and an indicator. An indicator is something which you measure, which measures some aspect of the service and gives you a numeric measure of that. A target is some sort of value of that indicator, an ideal, an aim, whatever, in which is used to drive, if you like, the system. You can have performance indicators without having targets. And if you do that, then the performance indicators themselves, the inter-service unit provider variation in those data, will tell you about well-performing, poorly performing units, and there is the potential to use that data without any external norm of a target in order to drive improvement. And approaches like that can lead to progressive improvements as lessons are learned and applied across all units in time. It still needs an active management system. It still needs very active use of the performance indicator measures that are being produced, but it doesn't necessarily contain targets as well. The extreme targets, such as there will be no case of something or no one will wait beyond a particular length of time, those sorts of extreme targets, while they are easy to articulate, easy, particularly in a political debate, easy to articulate and explain, they have the potential, I think, for the greatest distortion, particularly in the cases where it becomes harder and harder to meet those last cases and the failure of the system, if you like, or the failure of the performance of the individual service unit is dependent upon the individual case. So there is a real problem about very extreme targets of that kind. On the other hand, one can see the dilemma, because if one chooses targets which are, in a sense, attainable, then almost for sure some of the service units will already be attaining them or be very close to attaining them, and that will not provide sufficient incentivization for driving up progressively performance. And so there is this dilemma between these two things. I think my implication from this is that there is this potential for extreme distortion when one chooses extreme targets is something which needs to be taken on board. And I would argue, I think, either for no targets at all or for data-driven targets, which are based upon an analysis of what's achievable, which can be progressively wrapped up over time in order to get greater performance. The other aspect of this, and this is one of my two statistician points, I suppose, the other aspect of this is also, I think, is unhelpful, is this over-interpretation being a very serious problem in terms of presentation. And this is particularly true in terms of league tables. And league tables are produced ostensibly because it helps with public choice and helps public to identify and understand sort of the performance of their local unit. But there is very little attention given to the uncertainty that's contained within such tables. And in fact, a lot of the league table variation is actually due to noise rather than any signal. And there is an implication, I think, here, for me at least, that this underlying uncertainty needs to be taken into account. And there are much better ways of displaying performance indicator activity than by simple league tables. But they are beloved by the media, no less than by political decision makers. The next lesson is this whole area, really, about the use of indicators leading to unintended consequences. Perverse behaviours, gaming behaviours, misrepresentation, dishonesty of data reporting. And as a statistician, I suppose my first reaction to that is that there are many examples of it, and it does indicate a much greater need to pay attention to techie, uninteresting things like data definitions, the precise definitions and processes which have to be gone through in order to provide the data which is there, data collection, codification, editing, and so on, if gaming and misrepresentation and things of that kind are to be eradicated. But it's also part of a bigger picture where data collection and monitoring is seen to be itself an intrusion, overly bureaucratic, a distraction from the real business of providing the service, and that the costs could be eliminated and the funds redirected towards the basic service. And in some cases, the cost falls on the service provider if the data collection simply reflects aspects of the service, but the client, the receiver of the service, is actually not directly involved, except that any money which is not spent on providing the service overall is, in a sense, an opportunity cost to those that access the service. But there are other forms of monitoring, education, children's attainment testing, for example, where the cost falls both on the service but also on the clients. And there is time spent by the client, in this case school children, being prepared for undertaking attainment tests and so on. And here there is a much clearer picture of the relevant cost, if you like, and a cost which is borne both by the service and by the clients that access it. Indeed, there is, in this area, growing evidence of a convergent view between frontline staff and political leaders for quite a strong reduction, I would imagine, in the range and use of performance indicators, particularly in areas like education. But the underlying cause of gaming and of this concern is that the staff members who are directly involved in providing the service do not see the use of performance indicators as beneficial to the way that they provide the service. Rather, they see themselves really as victims of the performance monitoring system. So as a management process, it is disincentivation rather than incentivation. And it's tied up with this image of punitive management regimes and things of that kind. Now, there are counterexamples. And there are counterexamples where performance information is used directly by staff to actually improve the service. And they take ownership of the data, and they take ownership of that in order to understand what works, what doesn't work, and so on, and drive forward progress. It may be a slightly slower process, and it's certainly much less top-down, but there is evidence that if one can get staff that provide the service to engage in that way, then there can be benefits that come from it. There is an argument which is being put that performance management in an austere climate of public funding is such that one should simply reduce or eradicate the money that's being spent on the performance monitoring exercise in order to allow available funds to be directed to frontline services and so on. I think one could easily put forward the opposite case, which is that when funds are tight, managers need to ensure that these are being used effectively. They need to maximise the benefit to the clients and that performance monitoring helps in that respect. And I think that all we've heard today already suggests that there is absolutely a need for some form of incentivisation, and I believe that within that, an aspect of that incentivisation will be performance monitoring. What I would say, but just to finish that point, that however, I come back to the political dimension of the next election, and it seems to me very unclear whether the use of performance monitoring of public services will be as uniformly maintained as it has been by the current administration. It's clear in some areas that things will be scaled back, I think. But there are also areas where management information, performance indicators and so on are much more strongly embedded in the management culture and have proved valuable. What comes out of all of that for me, and it's one of my summary points, is that the process of deciding on performance indicators, target setting if we do have targets and so on, needs to be revisited. There is, I think, much greater potential to involve the public, to take on board the public choice dimension, if you like, of the alternative way of incentivising, by trying to embed, if you like, performance management targets and performance indicators in a wider consultation, which may well involve the staff that deliver the service. My view is that there is some form of incentivisation. It will be needed. Performance monitoring has a role to play in that. And I think I'd like to make a plea, and that is that a lot of the criticism we've heard of performance monitoring and performance indicators are based upon other information other than the information that's being collected for performance indicators. In other words, a wider, more holistic picture about the way that the service was being provided. And it seems to me that whatever system of incentivisation is needed, what we fundamentally need is to make sure that the data sources which underpin that wider understanding of the way that an organisation functions are not eroded during a period of public austerity. Because if we lose the ability to monitor what's happening under any system of incentivisation, then there could well be situations where some of the effects are really quite negative and we are not learning how better to employ incentivisation in public services beyond that. Thank you.
I think there should be a target for how fast speakers have to walk. It should be lower than this next time. Anyway, I want to start by making three remarks about numbers and targets and performance, which is firstly that, as we all know, targets are always partial. Even if there are 412 of them for the National Health Service, that is still going to be targeting a very small proportion of health service activity. In contrast, choice allows users to take into account things in a much more holistic manner. Secondly, I think there's a real danger with targets that they will encourage excessive uniformity, that they can undermine innovation. None of us can really imagine Ryanair, which is a very successful and popular airline, having been generated by some system of targets to improve the airline industry. If we look downstairs at the poster by Sue White and her colleagues, it talks about that in the context of child protection. Thirdly, numerical targets have a tendency to be about output and performance rather than about value for money. So they can be quite good at ratcheting up standards, but they can also be quite good at ratcheting up costs. And again, downstairs there's a poster by Mary O'Mahony that looks at problems of that in the NHS. So notwithstanding those really quite big problems about targets and about the use of numbers, I think we still need to accept that numerical targets are useful, particularly when choice is not an option. I think we should also begin to think about how public services can use targets within themselves, i.e. targets that have not been generated by politicians, to push forward their own performance. So what do I think we've learned? Well, the first thing I think we've learned from the projects that are downstairs is that targets are definitely better than trust if users are captive. And here, Frank Windmeyer's work on targets versus terror, comparing England and Scotland, when England had NHS targets and Scotland didn't, is very useful. People in England got treated 13 days earlier. And by and large, I think we can agree that's a good thing. The second thing I think we've learned is that workers and managers definitely try to evade targets when they can. And again, Frank found evidence of people being shunted off and put back on and whatever of these waiting lists as hospitals tried to pretend that they were doing better than they were. The result that the targets worked remains valid, but you do have to be careful. Again, Guthrie and colleagues downstairs, more work on exactly that. How do people game targets? From my own work, I've looked at the history of trains since 1850, and ever since we invented the Citizens' Charter, train times have stopped getting faster in the way they had done for the previous 100 years, because we now fined train companies for being late. Last week I came back from Cardiff. There was 24 minutes of padding in the journey. I know that because we stopped for 13 minutes outside Reading owing to a signal fault, and we still got to Paddington 11 minutes early. And that's not a meaningful target if it's are you more than 24 minutes slower than you can easily do the journey in. That's just not the way we should be doing things. The other thing I think we should be more aware of, and I don't think that's come out so far today, is that targets let some people off the hook. So education targets are usually expressed in absolute values. So last week, the Evening Standard reported that Kingston Council in southwest London, where I live, was the third best council on key stage two results. But actually, when I downloaded the data and looked up the value-added data, they were the 22nd best council out of 33, which is a rather different performance. But because we look at absolute values, Kingston Council, quite frankly, are smug and complacent when it comes to education, and they just bask in the glory of the fact that basically people in the area are affluent rather than that the schools are any good. So what do I think we need to do? Well, the first thing I think we need to do is really to identify much more strongly with users when we devise targets. Targets often seem designed for politicians rather than for users. Is what's really being searched for in this service being captured? However, I don't think we should think about users too much. We could survey people leaving hospital to say, do you think the hospital did everything that they could do? And we might find for those people who've gone through one of the ultimate tragedies of seeing their baby die that they believe the hospital did everything they could. But it remains a demonstrable, verifiable, numerical fact that 25 babies a week die in Britain who would not die if we matched Swedish infant mortality statistics. It doesn't matter what those parents think about the hospital. The number that matters there is 25 a week. So sometimes we have to say the customer does not know best, that we do know things that are showing failure when it is not perceived. We clearly need to attack moral hazard. We need to attack the ability of users to game the system. So in railways, that means that we've got to get rid of these punctuality statistics and replace them with a combination of punctuality and timetable statistics. We cannot go around rewarding companies who just add in huge amounts of time to the timetable in order that it's never late. That's just silly. For GCSEs, we need to replace this rather simplistic do you get 5 A's to C's or not with something that rewards schools for every GCSE they get, including the 4th one for a kid who'd otherwise get 3 and the 11th one for a kid who'd otherwise get 10. But the other thing that I want to say, the final theme, is that we need to start looking within the units. We need to start looking within schools, within hospitals, within police forces. Because targets are almost always at the level of the school, the hospital, the police force. And what we actually know is that a huge amount of the variation in performance is within the school, within the hospital, etc. Now, that's not to say that we want a government target that every individual teacher shall achieve 34.78 value-added points per year corrected for, you know, no, that can't happen. But what we need to do is empower and perhaps even require that people who are running these services start looking within their units rather than treating them as a single group. Debbie Cohen at Cardiff has done work on that. You can read the poster downstairs. And that also relates to equipping people to improve. We're rather prone just to using targets to evaluate schools. I was talking to my school governors, and of course they get the results, and they kind of view it as a judgment, but they don't view it as a mechanism to improve. And unless you equip people with information about how to improve, you cannot expect them to do so. It's no good university academics just writing on the bottom of essays, 62, 47, 33. Unless you tell the kid who's got 33 what they need to do better, you cannot be surprised if they don't improve.
So there's all sorts of evidence about what does and does not work. Kieran Walsh from Manchester downstairs has a paper on that. Tim's comments a few minutes ago about ratcheting up. In the world of schools, there's huge amounts of evidence about what improves standards and what doesn't. And one thing we know that doesn't work is school trips. And yet schools persist in taking kids on trips, which are hellishly difficult to organise, very expensive, and have no discernible educational outcome. You know, we are not using evidence in a way that we could. And here targets often generate numerical evidence that can be used. The LSE does an evaluation of every single teacher every single year. And we just use that to pat a few people on the head. Now, we could use that for so much more. We could work out whether those people who teach at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning consistently get worse results. And that would tell us that actually, maybe we should just accept that students are rubbish at getting up in the morning and they don't learn anything at 9 a.m. because they're hungover, tired, whatever it is. I mean, any of you who work with students will know they don't tend to be at their best at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning, particularly not if they've had to commute in from 25 miles away. LSE manages to timetable some students to have 6 hours of teaching in one day. Now, I'm prepared to wager that those students don't learn a lot in the 6 hour and they give bad teaching evaluations, but we don't actually test this, and we could. Generating data is really expensive, and when we've generated that data, we should mine it like anything in lots of ways to see what works and what doesn't. And that means that data has to be made available, anonymized maybe, but made available to researchers, to policymakers, to managers. We all need that data if we're to improve public services, particularly without cost. So, to conclude, targets can be improved. But what I think the critical agenda for the next decade is how do we use numbers to improve performance by seeing them as a basis of evidence? We don't just need evidence-based policy making. We also need evidence-based policy delivery. And numbers generated by targets can be a very useful and powerful part in delivering that sort of agenda.
I think I've just missed my target for getting here quickest. I apologise for that. I think what I'm going to say is going to echo some of the themes that Tim and Tim have brought up, and also some of the themes that came out from the previous sessions. I mean, it's obviously the case that there's been an increasing reliance on managing by numbers, on using these performance metrics and indicators as part of metrics-based accountability mechanisms like benchmarks, rankings. It's certainly more so in England now than in the other devolved administrations, and I think that's an issue that we could debate and probably was debated in another room previously. So it's a good time to take stock and think about future use. The rise in these things has been in the background of monitoring and measuring public service performance with rising budgets, and that's obviously going to stop being the case in the next decade or so. So I'm going to look at, you know, what do we know about these things called performance indicators and how can we think about their use in the future with this new context. It's also particularly timely given Gordon Brown's speech earlier this week and the publication of the document Putting the Front Line First, Smarter Government. And I think the front line has already been picked at the Today programme, been wandering around talking about front line this and front line that. So that's obviously going to be a new buzzword. And I'm going to refer to that document as I go through. I think the first point to emphasise, and I probably would say this being the Deputy Director of the programme, is that there is a growing evidence base on the strengths and the shortcomings, both of the numbers themselves and the types of indicators that are employed, and also relatedly but distinctly, I think, to the uses to which they are put. So we have issues around the actual numbers and issues around the metrics-based accountability mechanisms of which they usually, but picking up on what Tim said, not necessarily form a part. As Tim Leunig's also said, there's also increasing evidence on how people and individuals and organisations respond to these things, but that's been talked about, so I'm going to leave that to one side. There's actually much less evidence on whether or not they achieve their aims, which I think should be, you know, the aim of improving quality, and possibly an increasing number of evidence very quickly at what cost they achieve the aims, and I'll come back to that later. So just very brief examples of what we know, the evidence we know about first the shortcomings of the numbers themselves, certainly in terms of what are called composite indicators, where an enormous amount of information is magically condensed to a number of stars per hospital or the latest equivalent. I think there's a lot of evidence now to suggest that there are some problems in the way these numbers are calculated and how sensitive the resultant rankings are to how they're calculated, both in terms of the type of information, the bits of data that are put together to make up these things, and also how the aggregation rules, how they're weighted. And Rowena Jacobs and colleagues in the programme have shown that in the context of hospital star ratings. So there's a bunch of issues, regardless of how they're used, about the actual calculation of the numbers, these composite indicators themselves. There's also issues around raw outcome measures, which has already been talked about, the kind of test scores, the 5A to C, and how actually they're a very imperfect measure of any kind of effectiveness of, in this case, schools. And that's the case for any kind of raw outcome indicator. It will always have a measure of input as well as output, and that creates some quite perverse incentives for the organisations themselves. And actually, as a consequence, the contextual value added measure, CVA, was introduced to try and address some of the shortcomings that were seen from the GCSE test results measures. And that tries to take account of the demographics of the school intake and therefore tries to produce a better measure of school effectiveness, of the impact of on the pupils and the progress of the pupils of the school itself. And I think, you know, it's fair to say that there is more useful performance management information in a CVA measure than there is in a 5A to C type target. But the problem with that is then how it's used. And I'm going to press the green button, and it works, first one this afternoon. Because actually, even though this CVA measure contains quite a lot of useful performance information, as Tim, who is going to answer all the statistical questions on this later, as I'm not a statistician, as Tim has mentioned, if you take account of the uncertainty associated with calculating these things, trying to rank schools on the basis of CVA is actually largely meaningless. And this is work that I did with Annette Pybalger in Bristol. And it's all secondary schools in England, and literally we ranked them from 1 to 3,000. And it's only those whose confidence intervals don't hit the zero can be distinguished from the national average. So if you try and rank schools on the basis of what is quite a useful piece of performance information, half of them can't be distinguished, yet their parents are being asked to, the information is out there for parents to use to rank schools in their locality. So even though the information is useful, the use to which it's put in this kind of rankings exercise, that's where the problem lies, and it becomes rather spurious. So there is some evidence, both on the numbers and on the uses to which they're put. I mean, I think it's fair to say, whatever the administration is next year, the management by numbers isn't likely to disappear. The genie can't be put back in the bottle, and I'm not suggesting that it should. And in fact, the current administration must have been listening to Tim Leunig, I think, because in the document that I mentioned earlier that's just been published, They have plans to harness the power of comparative data to improve standards. They will be publishing unprecedented amounts of performance data, using it to drive performance. So, Tim, you've got the ear of government and didn't know it, I think. And in that context, I'm going to just mention three policy issues that I think are worth considering for these times of fiscal constraint. And some of them, I think, are complement rather than repeat what's already been said. First, there is the open question of what is it that we should be measuring, and indeed how much we should be measuring, how many resources we should put to the measurement of these things. I think we're seeing what might be an expected shift towards input reduction, towards productivity, towards value for money, taking account of the cost of achieving these outcomes or these better outcomes, and that would be to be expected. What doesn't seem to be happening, as far as I can pick up yet, is what I think would be politically prudent to do, would be to reduce the emphasis on user satisfaction measures as part of a performance regime, because, you know, more or the same amount is going to have to be provided for less, and if the quality of that service is partly being judged on user satisfaction at a time when budgets are being cut and services might be being cut, then you might expect actually organisations to look worse simply because of that. And I think the conversation this morning around reasonable expectations links in with this. The new policy document talks about enforceable guarantees for citizens over the services they receive, and that suggests some kind of minimum standard. So I think, you know, user satisfaction expectations, minimum standards, however they might be enforceable, is something to watch out for. I think also how much to measure and how many resources should be taken away from frontline services. Extraordinarily back-of-the-envelope calculations. So this is as far as we could get for a policy briefing that we did earlier this year. These are the kind of numbers that are involved, and I'm not being normative here, but this is a debate that was obviously not going to go away, and you'll expect pressure on this kind of regulation to increase as a result. There's also a kind of a debate to be had as to whether or not the state should provide these numbers anyway. The UK scores very low on trust in official statistics. So politically, I'm not sure how much mileage there is in publishing statistics that people don't believe in anyway. But I think that's a separate issue. My second point really is that, again, echoing what we've heard, is that better data is certainly necessary, but I would say not sufficient for better managing by numbers. Two points here. I think definitely there is more scope for learning from comparison. So these are the harnessing the power of comparative data might be a good thing. But actually, there's the devil's in the detail. And we can talk about comparable data. What seems to be less the case is that this data is commensurable, that it actually can be compared in a rational, in a kind of same units, correct way. And I think that will create barriers to actually learning from comparison. And that's a theme that's certainly come out of a group of programme projects that has tried, particularly looking across the countries of the UK, to compare and to learn from similar policy domains across different countries. There are barriers to the commensurability of data that I think needs to be thought about. And then my second point under the kind of the better data argument was summed up, I've obviously been reading too many government documents this week, summed up in it's a footnote in small print at the bottom of a four-page spreadsheet of very small numbers in one of the annexes to this Smarter Government document. And I quote, "Exercise care and judgment in comparing data. See, benchmarking the back office, central government, for details and commentary." So unprecedented amounts of data will be published. Data can be misrepresented, it can be misused, and it can simply be misunderstood. And if the same data is being published for different purposes or for different stakeholders, the professionals, the newly empowered, informed citizens, then I think there's a real issue about how that data is put out, the learning and the education that is required for the different stakeholders to understand that data and respond to it in what might be called a desired way. Yeah, just one more point. So just to kind of sum up, really, I mean, I think, again, I'm echoing what Tim said, and I think it also links this session with the session in this room before lunch. More generally, there's a question about how much do we know when certain types of indicator are used best within different types of accountability mechanism. They don't necessarily have to be coupled with targets and rankings. In the literature, we're talking in terms of use of intelligence to evaluate policy, not in a soft way, but maybe in a less predictable way, in a more evaluative way. Government is going to publish unprecedented amounts of data, quote, whether through more sophisticated performance management or regulatory frameworks, or where appropriate, payment mechanisms and stronger local scrutiny mechanisms. And it's all there, it's just I'm not sure anyone knows which bits go with which. And I think more careful thought is needed about that in order to stop carrying on following these short-term fads in the 2010s. Thank you.
Okay, plenty of food for thought there. Can I throw it open to the floor then, please? Can you give your name and affiliation?
Tim Blackman from Durham University. Nice to see so many Tims in this session, actually. I wanted to come back to outcomes, and I'd be interested in the panel's thoughts about outcomes that are of some social significance, the cross-cutting ones. I've been doing some work as part of this programme on health inequalities and teenage pregnancies. So those are wicked issues, tricky outcomes. And in many ways, they're smart indicators, because if you can tackle teenage pregnancies, then a lot of other things are going to improve. It's interesting that those are examples of targets. We have targets for those. And in fact, they're examples of targets that aren't working. Life expectancy is going backwards in terms of the gap, not in terms of overall improvement, in terms of the gap between deprived and non-deprived areas. Teenage pregnancies, we're missing the target massively. The reason for that may be because they're tier two targets. They're not sort of P45 targets, and that's because of the difficulties of partly making causal attribution. But where we're seeing some progress, I think, with those socially significant cross-cutting targets is where we are able to equip local public bodies with the tools to help them put in place the theory of change with if you like, what's sometimes called logic models. And this seems to be the gap in the discussion. We talk about targets, we talk about activities, but there's this black box in between, which is, you know, how are organisations supposed to actually do this? For things like waiting times, it's fairly straightforward in many ways. You know, you put money in, you put attention in. But these other cross-cutting issues, more difficult. But we see success because in some areas where we're actually passing on the tools to model how to reach these cross-cutting areas. And it seems to me this is a very neglected area. Scottish Government's beginning to move on it with the development of logic models for tackling cross-cutting issues. So I'd be interested in some comments on that.
Okay, thank you very much. I suggest we collect two or three comments.
Richard Tebbeth, Welsh Assembly Government. Following up the point made by Tim behind me, something that very much interests us as we're moving more towards an outcome-orientated thing. And I suppose a comment on that, a general comment, that the kind of counting we've been doing, the sort of PI-type counting, sort of counting everything in process ways, seems to me that a shift towards an outcome approach implies a shift from a sort of compliance audit-type counting towards something that's more a social research sort of base, where we need a greater variety of means of evaluating and where we concentrate much more clearly on the questions we're trying to answer rather than just the maths.
Thank you. Martin. To your left, Martin. I know you find it difficult to look leftwards, Martin, but that's fine.
I've seen the microphone. Martin Wheeler from the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. I'd like to pick up on the point that Deborah made, that maybe we ought to give rather less weight to measures of satisfaction, because measures of satisfaction are, you know, quite possibly going to decline. I did find myself wondering whether actually that was putting things the wrong way round. If satisfaction is important relative to other things that services are delivering, then surely we need to focus on satisfaction and let other things like, whatever hospitals do, saving lives and so on, decline, let mortality rates rise in order to keep the patients happy. Or maybe what you're saying is that actually we shouldn't have given as much weight to patient satisfaction as does often seem to be, to user satisfaction as does often seem to be given. Could you clarify that, please?
Okay, thanks very much, Ian. Can we then have some short, snappy responses to that? And to put you in the... I shall start at the far right. So, Deborah, if while it's hot in your mind, you could respond to that one.
Yeah, just to pick up on them, what's important to measure? What is performance? What is quality? And this links both kind of to the satisfaction point, but also the broader outcomes point that Tim and Richard both made. And I think this is going to be, it would be a challenge in rising budgets time, and it's certainly going to be a challenge in times of falling budgets. One of the issues, I think, is the whole issue of risk and how risk can be attributed across the different organisations that are undoubtedly going to be involved in providing the outcome in this kind of cross-cutting or area-based approach. And I think I'm just not sure how that is actually going to pan out on the ground. And I think then, given that kind of issue around what actually the outcome is that we're trying to improve, I'm not sure, actually picking up on Tim's point, I'm not sure that we should assume that the patient, the pupil, the whoever always knows best, and therefore that their measure of satisfaction would mean that we're providing a better service.
Thanks, Tim. Tim Hall.
Thank you. Starting, I suppose, at the top with the points that Tim made about teenage pregnancy and health inequalities and so on, it seems to me what you were describing is something which I guess all of us would strongly support and advocate, which is not a simple method of measuring a certain number of performance indicators. One really needs to understand much more deeply the system of, you know, how teenage pregnancy can be affected and so on. It sounds much more like a proper social research activity, but with a mechanism for feeding back the findings of that into better practice and better public policy. And in fact, it is taking us away from a rather simplistic dependence upon a set of performance indicators as such. So I think that what you describe seems to me to be really very beneficial if we have a mechanism to spread that further. On the question of outcomes and so on, it's actually tied into the same point. What I would say is that greater emphasis on outcomes is clearly desirable, and a greater dependence on variety of methods to evaluate those is also desirable. I don't know whether your comments suggested that one therefore did not need any sort of systematic comparable measure of outcomes across the system. I would argue that you do, because you need some sort of backcloth of outcome measures in order to embed whatever evaluation you're doing within that. And so the two things, I think, complement each other. They're not alternatives. On the question of measures of satisfaction, I have a slightly different worry about measures of satisfaction, and that is that I suppose in economist jargon, I suspect that there's a sort of user satisfaction elasticity, which means that people's satisfaction will not deteriorate at the same rate as the deterioration of the quality of the service which they're enjoying, and particularly if they don't have sufficient information about the level of that service and how that's changing over time. So my worry about depending too heavily on user satisfaction is that it could be a very lagged indicator.
Okay, thanks, Tim.
The questions have been answered pretty well, so I'm only going to add one thing, which is that to expect evidence-based policy making or evidence-based policy delivery on any policy area related to either sex or drugs seems to me to be very unlikely to happen. Politicians will always want to posture on these things, because on these things, at least, posturing is what gets you votes. So I'm afraid teenage pregnancy, we're not going to get good outcomes because there just isn't the political will to do the things that get good outcomes.
Okay, thanks.
Lauren Cumming, 2020 Public Services Trust. It hasn't been discussed here today, but in other fora, the idea that we should be measuring and harnessing informal resources is desirable in an era of austerity. And I wondered if you could comment on what might be kind of undesired consequences of formalizing those informal contributions to public services, and what other challenges might be to collecting that kind of data.
Can you just explain a little bit by what you mean by informal resources?
Sort of time donation or an idea of time credit, time banks or care credits, that kind of a system.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. At the second one, about that place, yeah. Thanks. Sorry about that.
I'm not quite sure how the success of the programme overall is going to be judged, but can I add a user perspective to this? Andrew Lickerman, National Audit Office and London Business School. I'm slightly concerned that many of the issues which have been raised in this session are identical to the issues raised 10, 20 and 30 years ago. And I'm slightly concerned that if we have another conference in 10 years and 20 years' time, we'll be having the same issues again. The issues and the problems of performance measurement are extremely well known, and they've been raised again this afternoon. My worry is that if that is the outcome of the programme, I don't think it's going to have a very profound effect on policymaking or on action. And may I offer a plea to say that as part of the programme, could we have a little more on the question, why is it that these lessons have not been learned, and what is it we now need to do to embed the kind of lessons that we all know, or rather the evidence shows very clearly, that we would need to take are actually going to be able to be implemented?
University College London. I wanted to pick up a remark that Deborah made about trust in government statistics and raise the question in relation to all performance measurement, who is the right person to generate the data, to collate it, analyze it, and publish it? And in the examples that Deborah gave on her slide of Ofsted and the Care Quality Commission, we saw two government bodies set up to monitor and evaluate the performance of other government bodies delivering public services. And all of us in the room can think probably of a few independent bodies like the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which have a good independent reputation for monitoring performance. So my question to the panel, I think, is what do you think is the scope in the fields of public service that you know well for independent monitoring of that kind? And do you see any likelihood of more of that kind of work being contracted out at a time when government and government budgets are going to shrink?
Thank you very much for that. I think I'll start at this end this time.
Informal resources, I think, by and large, should be ignored, I'm afraid. Most people who help their neighbours and so on do so because they like their neighbours or they're good citizens, and frankly, going to the effort of rewarding them or recording it doesn't strike me as a high priority. On why we don't learn lessons, it's because politicians don't get punished enough for doing the right, for doing the wrong thing. Paul Collier, who wrote a superb book, The Bottom Billion, which I recommend to any of you who haven't read it, he gave a paper to launch that at the LSE in which he said he thought it was the 14th book he'd written, but he said it's the first book he'd written to be read. The others were as a line on an academic CV. And he had realised that in the 1970s, the British population stopped voting for politicians who promised them that inflation would get them zero unemployment and everything would be well, and started voting for politicians who understood macroeconomics. He wanted people to start voting for politicians who understood development economics, so they actually implemented development policies that worked rather than development policies that win votes. And I think he was right. So what we need to do is to work out how to get people to vote for politicians who enact policies that work, because politicians enact policies that get them votes. So if those policies that work get them votes, then that's what they'll do. So I think that's the challenge for all of us in this room today who are part of this sort of public service academic life. We've got to work out how to get politicians elected if they do what we think they should do. Not because we wish to be powerful, but because then we'll get the policy outcomes we seek. The only thing I want to say on independent monitoring is I think the IFS, of which I am a member, is a much misunderstood body. The IFS are not an independent auditor. It's an academic think tank. It's not the IFS relies on data from the ONS and others. It's not really a body that says this is right or this is wrong or this has hit a target or anything like that. So I think this constant refrain of we need more bodies like the IFS, it's true that the IFS does great work, but I think all sorts of things are being attributed to the IFS that they can't really claim. So I don't know the answer to that, but it isn't the IFS.
So is it Dr. Foster? Tim? Oh, sorry, that's not for answering.
Thank you, Tim. I've got nothing to add to the first question about informal measures.
Andrew Lickerman's question about why is it the lessons have not been learned, Tim has given an answer. I suppose if one were slightly more charitable, one would give a slightly different answer, which is that often the time scale in which politicians are required to make decisions and put things in places are often outside the time frames within which academic and decent research can be done in order to address particular issues. But on these generic questions about how should one monitor performance and so on, there is a sufficient body of information available, and sadly it looks as if a lot of that, which was already known, has not really been taken on board as targets and measures have been identified. So maybe the answer is other Tim's response to that. Who should monitor? There's a growing fashion to say that it should be someone that's totally outside of government. I think, first of all, you need data. And we're talking here about public services, and therefore you have to have some leverage over the public services in terms of the levels and detail of data which is to be provided. And I think, actually, the government's fiscal service, and I put my hand up, has not been as effective as it should have been in terms of working on data standards, data definitional standards, the whole processes of collection and monitoring and evaluation and so on, in order to get that data into a fit state. And it should also do some of the analysis in order to evaluate that. If it does not do any of the analysis itself, it simply acts as a postbox, and that does not lead to quality improvement in terms of what it itself does. But neither should it be a monopoly. And what there should be is a system whereby others, the IFS is a good example, access all sorts of official data and do great things with it and produce very telling reports. But what you need is a system which allows those other bodies access and allows them to utilise the information in ways which government could never have conceived of, and that's actually one of the strengths.
I'll be brief. I worry about kind of formalising informal care and the data and the consequences of that, and I think that's a debate that possibly could be had, but I sort of can't. But I think it's a... there would be unintended consequences of that, and so I would worry about doing that. I think some lessons have been learnt. I'm not totally gloomy about it. I think the school league tables is a case in point. The value added, there's been a progression of performance measures for schools that have been introduced as responses to partly academic work, partly government research about the shortcomings of their predecessors. It's partly the media that kind of is still hooked on the not very satisfactory performance indicators, and that kind of the zeitgeist that gets into the system. So there's a long way to go, but I'm not as gloomy as Andrew is on that one. And just to add as about the government statistics, someone said to me at a conference in Cardiff the other week, you know, it's unsafe because there's no trust in government statistics. It's unsafe for ministers to talk about statistics on public service performance because they're not believed, but they don't want ministers not to use statistics as evidence for their policies on public service performance. How we square that circle, I'm not sure.
Thanks very much, Deborah. I'm going to further increase the number of enemies I have, if that's possible, by cutting things short now. So I'm sorry for those of you who are queuing up to talk further, because we are running out of time. Just like to say in conclusion, I'd like to address Andrew Lickerman's point about the outcome of this programme. It's not for me to defend the programme at all, and that will be something that I'm sure Christopher and Deborah will be very adept at. But one thing I would say is that this programme is largely speaking being undertaken by researchers labouring under extraordinarily difficult conditions of data availability and so on. The UK has had this, and specifically England, has had this remarkable experiment in the last 10 years in the public service agreement targets and other uses of information. The rest of the world is looking on with a mixture of admiration and horror at what is going on. And certainly I, for one, have dined out on many of the stories that one can tell about this. We have learnt a lot from what has been going on in this, and people are able to give evidence that's come from this experiment. So I think whatever the outcome of this, however much the users, how they judge this in the end, I think it has been a good shot to try this out. And I think there are some very good outcomes from it. But we have to remember that public services are probably one of the prime reasons they're public services is precisely because of the measurement difficulties. Yes. It's because we can't contract out a lot of these things. It's because we can't rely on user sovereignty for some of these things that they are public services. So it's hardly surprising that in this specific domain we have challenges. And I think bit by bit, incrementally, we are beginning to learn more about it. We are beginning to see where the big gains can be had. So I hope that when we do return with the next public service programme from the SRC, that we will make even more progress and that actually we will see all the users of information, not just managers, which this session was supposed to be about, but also users, more general citizens, professionals, and I think that was mentioned as being a key issue, professionals, politicians, and researchers are using that information to even better effect than they are now. So thanks for your contributions from the floor, but also thanks to the panel for some very good interventions and for really giving us further food for thought in this very difficult area. Thank you.